is life meaningless without God? To which Solomon, our teacher, would say, yes, yes it is. We read in verse 1 of chapter 1, the words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. The teacher, this is the Hebrew word Koheleth. Originally, the root word here is Kahal. This is basically a group, a gathering. For those who are students of the New Testament, you know that this word Kahal was translated into the Greek word ekklesia. And so an ekklesia is just a gathering. It could be a gathering of Christians. It could be a secular gathering, as in Acts 21, where they had a lynch mob and they called it an ekklesia. And so when we put this together, the translators of the Septuagint, the Greek translators of the Hebrew Bible, translated this book as Ecclesiastes. They changed the C's to K's. And what we have here is basically, well, actually, they don't have C's in Greek. They have a kappa. So they didn't change anything. Anyways, the point is, we changed it to C's to transliterate it. Ecclesiastes is the name of the book, and that's why, because of the teacher. Really, the Koheleth is basically like a professor who would gather students and really, in a Socratic method, you know, raise an issue and then press people's nerves, push people. It's a really form, really good form of a teaching or pedagogy when you can push people, push their worldview to its absolute extremes. And that's really what he does as a professor. As I said, the author here is Solomon, much to the chagrin of the critics. I can't figure out why they say it's somebody else other than Solomon. I've tried to read their stuff on this. They say this is a late-dated book. This is Hellenistic, whatever. Inside the book itself, it says that he's the son of David, king in Jerusalem. So that narrows down the list to about 20 guys, 42 kings in Israel. Only 20 of them were sons of David. And it says in verse 12 that he ruled over Israel from Jerusalem. That narrows it down even further because when the kingdom split with Rehoboam in Judah and Jeroboam in Israel, right after Solomon's death, I mean, within a day or two, no longer did the king in Judah, Jerusalem, rule over Israel. But here we see he's the son of David, king in Jerusalem. That is a lock right there. But we have more internal evidence. He possessed incredible wisdom. Oh, who possessed incredible wisdom in the Bible? Solomon. He accumulated incredible wealth. It got to the point in 1 Kings 10:21 where it says they no longer used silver because it was worthless. Solomon had so much gold. He had 666 talents of gold. And that equates to basically 50,000 pounds of gold that he was collecting every single year. That's how wealthy Solomon was. Incredibly wealthy, incredibly wise, and completely flush with women. This guy was sleeping around like crazy. He would make any guy on campus today blush by how much he was sleeping around. He had 1,000 concubines and or wives. When you got 300 concubines and 700 wives, they don't know which is which at that point. This guy was a very profligate fornicator, wild. And that's our author here. So what is a guy like this? Rich, wealthy, powerful, wise, intelligent. You know, men want to be him. Women want to be with him. What does this guy have to say to us? This is what he says. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What? I mean, he just completely blew out the American dream here. And he's saying, this is meaningless. And this is really this word here, this word hebel. Meaningless. Maybe your translation says vanity, something to that effect. This could be translated as a vapor or a breath. So think of taking a hit off that sick vape mod and you blow that up into the air and you know, it just disappears along with the rotten smell of strawberries and vanilla. And then it's gone. It's gone forever. And he's saying that's what this kind of a life is like. It's meaningless. It's hebel. It could be translated as vain. Not in the sense of vanity, in the sense that, you know, I'm trying to be such a narcissist and egomaniac, but in the sense that I tried to accomplish something and it was in vain. So he's saying this whole life is a vapor, a breath. It's worthless. It's vain. Hebel conveys the notions of transience, being temporary, and insubstantiality. And so, this is what we see here. And we're seeing in the Hebrew grammar, when the Hebrews wanted to intensify something, What they did is when they wanted to use a superlative, you know, like something was very meaningless or really meaningless, what they would do is they wouldn't put any kind of an adjective on there. What they would do is they would just repeat the noun or the adjective. So Jesus, truly, truly, I say to you. Or in Genesis, when Joseph is thrown into a pit, he doesn't say it's a very big pit or a large pit. It says it's a pit. And so here we see it's Hebel, Hebel, utterly Hebel. Everything is Hebel. So this is really Hebel is what he's saying. He's intensifying it for us. Then he says, what does anyone gain? This is the language of commercial profit, advantage, gain from all their labors at which they toil under the sun. Here's another expression, a prepositional phrase with which we should be acquainted. It occurs 29 times in this book and nowhere else in the Hebrew Bible. This is the only time this expression comes up. Under the sun is in the book of Ecclesiastes from here until chapter 10. It's synonymous with under heaven. So Solomon can say in the fifth chapter, the second verse, he says, God is in heaven, you are on earth. If heaven is synonymous with being over the sun and earth is synonymous with being under the sun, what's he communicating here? Simply this, that this is referring to life excluded from God. Being under the sun means that you're not factoring God into the equation. So think about that for a moment. As you read through this book, you'll run into statements that you'll just think to yourself, how could this be in the Bible? And you're not alone. Many of the Jewish rabbis debated this very book as to whether it should be in the Hebrew Bible because it's so skeptical, it's so cynical, and there's points where it even says things that people feel uncomfortable with. Well, there wasn't really a debate here. Eventually, they realized this is from the perspective of under the sun, apart from God. That's the picture that we're being given here. So, Solomon, living a life apart from God, what does he conclude? What does he come up with? What is the main message of the book of Ecclesiastes? Well, I'm going to read some commentators here. Stick with me. All right. I know it's going to be like, we're going from one guy to another. I just want to show you I'm not making this up here. Right? All right. J. Stafford Wright, he says this. He says, this book demonstrates that there is no firm foundation to find meaning, satisfaction, and the key to existence. Michael A. Eaton writes, what then is the purpose of Ecclesiastes? It is an essay in apologetics, or a defense of the Christian faith. It defends the life of faith in a generous God by pointing to the grimness of the alternative. In philosophy, we refer to this as a disjunctive syllogism. Either A or B, not A, therefore B. So life under the sun or life above the sun with God, not life under the sun. And Solomon is just going to pummel that away for 12 chapters until you're like, uncle, all right, God is where it's at. This is where it should be. Dwayne Garrett, he says, Ecclesiastes urges its readers to abandon all illusions of self-importance, face death and life squarely, and accept their dependence on God. Derek Kidner, Solomon is demolishing to rebuild. He's taking all these things on which we create a foundation for our lives, our meaning, our value, our purpose. And Solomon holds them up to the logic of a world apart from God, and he comes to the conclusion that this is Hebel. Hebel, Hebel, utterly Hebel, completely Hebel, worthless, meaningless. Kidner writes, path after path will be relentlessly explored to the very point at which it comes to nothing. In the end, only one way will be left. And so this is what most people will simply not face. Why is this book in our Bible? Because it just punches us, you know, left hook, right hook, jab, uppercut for 12 chapters until we're just completely getting, you know, worked over by the idea that all of our labors under the sun are vanity. They don't mean anything. What do they accumulate? Nothing. At the end of our lives, what do they mean? Nothing. Apart from God. You could think of it like this, like imagine, I know this is a trope, you crash land on a deserted island. You're like, this is in every sitcom, every 10 years, there's a show about people that, okay, bear with me here, okay? This island is 5 miles wide, and you crash land, and you come to your senses, and it's just you. You know, you're the only survivor, the sole survivor on this little 5-mile diameter island. And you start to walk around and you're realizing, you're looking at the supplies and you're like, I'm only going to make it maybe 3, 4, 5 days, 10 at the most. What could you do if you were in that situation to find meaning and significance on the island? Well, what about extending your time on that island? Maybe you would raid the liquor cabinets, you know. Maybe you would try and find some of the water in the plane that was on fire. Maybe you would try and find some of that nasty airplane food or whatever. Okay, you would try and get it from like maybe 5 days to 10 days or maybe 2 weeks. But would that give your time on the island significance? Just by adding days to your time? Well, no, just adding 24 hours or 48 hours, that wouldn't give your time there any kind of meaning. You can't get meaning by just adding successive days. What about if you found, like in the show Lost, you found the others, and they're on the other side of the island, and you find more survivors? Would that add to your ability to have meaning and significance on the island? Well, if one person lacks significance, how would finding another person who lacks significance help your problem with significance? We're all doomed to die. You know, maybe we could find some coconuts and make a raft and, you know, do our best to get off the island. But if it's truly the case that this is a closed system and we're surrounded by, you know, hostile oceans and we can't get off this island, we're in trouble. And having more people, just adding successively more people, it wouldn't matter if there was, you know, 2 people or 7 or 7 billion people on this island. That wouldn't add to meaning or significance whatsoever. Well, what about, in the final analysis, having a bigger island? Like, what if instead of 5 miles, that island was 50 miles in diameter? Ooh, maybe that would solve the problem of meaning. No, adding size to the island wouldn't fix your significance. Do you see where I'm going with this? You see, we're on the island. All of us, right now, we are on the island. We're surrounded by a hostile universe. We've made it to the moon. Maybe Elon Musk will take us to Mars. It doesn't seem like it's going to solve our predicament any. We're all going to die. We're a species that is currently hurtling toward death and extinction. Now, our island isn't 5 miles, you know, around. Our island is actually 25,000 miles around, and we don't have one survivor or two or seven. We have 7.3 billion. And we might live for another 10 years or 100 years or 1,000 years, but eventually, the size of our island, the survivors on our island, the time on our island doesn't change the significance one iota. It changes it nothing. And this is what people won't face. You know, some people have said to me, I've explained this. I mean, this is as clear as day. We are the walking dead. Like, our bodies are currently going through the second law of thermodynamics. Entropy. We're rotting. It's like, hey, you're rotting, so have a nice day. We're just walking along, ready to die at any minute. And this could happen tomorrow. It could happen in 60 years. We don't know when, but we know the finality of death is certain. And in that grim prospect, people have said, well, why can't we just make up our own meaning? Well, you can. You can do that. But your meaning would be subjective. It would not be objective. Do you know the difference between the two? The difference is that the meaning comes in the subject, me, versus in the object out there in the world. So if I was to say that chocolate ice cream is tasty, that would be a subjective claim that I personally like chocolate ice cream. But if I were to say chocolate ice cream is brown, that would be an objective claim about the ice cream, the object. Get my point? The same is true here. We could say my meaning to life is helping the poor. All right? You could say that. But in a universe that's indifferent to your feelings, how does that make it objective? It doesn't. Can't you see that? One person could say, I want to help the poor. Other people could say, my purpose and significance in life is stealing from the poor. And it just shows we're both inventing a meaning here. That's why our meanings often contradict. You find some people that are like, well, I want to save, you know, all the animals around the city of Columbus and do whatever I can to help the animals. And other people are like, I want to kill off the animals because they're pests. That's my significance in life. Who's to say who's right and who is wrong? We're all biochemical machines doomed to death. Who gives you the right to say that you're in the right and someone else is in the wrong? Some people have said, well, yeah, but my meaning in life, like subjectively, it makes me very happy. I'm very glad to hear that. Like, I'm glad you didn't pick a meaning to life that made you very sour and bitter. But meaning is not the same as happiness, right? We know this, right? Like sometimes I could be suffering, but feeling a tremendous amount of meaning. And there's other times that I could be feeling extreme pleasure and happiness with little to no meaning. I could go to an amusement park and be having a lot of happiness, but I would never, never confuse that with a meaningful experience. I remember talking to one agnostic student. He was an engineer, and for some reason I got dragged into this conversation at our beach vacation one time. And we sat down and we went through all this, and I gave him some illustrations and, you know, my Sartre and Friedrich Nietzsche and, you know, all the different thinkers on this and how they thought about it. And we had a really good conversation. He was a sweetheart of a guy. And at the very end, he said, "Well, James, isn't a subjective meaning good enough?" And I had one of those moments where I kind of like bit my tongue because I was like, I had a lot to say about that, but I was just like, I don't know. What do you think? And he looked up into the sky. I never forget. It was dark at night. The stars were out. He looked up at the sky and he said, "No, no, it's not good enough." Maybe he didn't scream that loud. Maybe that was just me in my heart. Like, yes. No, it's not good enough that we just walk around with a subjective meaning. That's absurd. So we just get to pretend. We get to, like, we're adults, like pretending there's a meaning in life when there really isn't. People just won't face this central claim, and they just keep moving right along. And you're like, well, how does this work? It's because they don't think about it. The inevitability of death and the futility and absurdity of life. And so Solomon writes, "Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever." The human habitat is going to last longer than humanity itself. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they will return again. What's he saying? He's saying that the planetary cycle is just as monotonous and meaningless as our lives. The sun hurries back. The wind returns to its course. The streams return again. It's like you'd see the sun leaving, you know, at night, and you're like, bon voyage, sun, good luck, you know, and you're like, man, the sun, really going places. And then 7:30 the next day, you're like, ah, it's you again, you know, it's like, it's like you're here every morning, and it's just the same thing over and over. The wind, it blows away, and it comes right back. And the streams, they go down, and they come right back. And it's a planetary cycle. And what's the point? What is point? That's life. That's life. It's just a cycle that just goes on and on, and then it's just a grind that we just keep going through over and over and over. We could think about it like this. Jean-Paul Sartre, he was a French existentialist in the mid to late 20th century. He said this: "No finite point has any meaning unless it has an infinite point of reference." What is he saying? Well, think of it like this. Here's an XY axis. In that little red dot in the middle, what we see right there, that's what we call what? It's called the point of origin. So on an infinite field, we have a point of origin right in the middle. And because the point of origin exists, now we can have certain numerical markers, right? With me? Past ninth grade math? With me? Okay. Now, because that point of origin exists, and because we have an X and a Y axis, we can do something. We can plot a second point on the XY axis. And this point can have a value. This point can have an objective value. The value is 3, 4 over 3 and up 4 from what? Well, not just from some relative feeling in my gut, or I get to make up the value of what it is. It's over 3 and up 4 from the point of origin in an objective sense. Now, here's Sartre's point. What happens if you get rid of the point of origin? Well, if that was the case, then the vertices would have to go with it. And now what do you have? You have a floating point in the recesses of space, spinning on an axis of 1,000 miles an hour, going through the cosmos at lightning speed, and it's just, now we got little primates on that ball of rock going through the universe, and now we're still going to honestly say, without a point of origin, without anything to ground the value of that dot, that it's still 3, 4. When you get rid of the point of origin, all you have is a dot, and you could make up any value that you want. You could say it's over 3 and up 20. You could say it's down 15 and over 10. Any value would be equally true and equally false. And this is the predicament in which we find ourselves. That dot right there has no meaning. That's Sartre's point. Unless we have an infinite point of reference. This is the conclusion of the book of Ecclesiastes, where Solomon says this. He says in chapter 12, verse 13, here is the conclusion of the matter. Stand in awe of God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of every human being. Whoa! So, if we put God into the equation, all of a sudden we wouldn't just be, you know, meat machines that are getting ready to be killed and to die, fall over dead and expire. We would be incredibly valuable. There would be an afterlife. We would be have an incredible purpose if that was the case. Jacques Monod, he unpacks this very well. Atheistic biochemist, Nobel Prize winner. These are no schlubs here, all right? These are academics here. Nobel Prize winner. This is what he said. Man must at last awake to his total solitude, his fundamental isolation. He lives on the boundary of an alien world, a world that is deaf to his music, just as indifferent to his hopes as it is to his suffering or his crimes. But who is to define crime? Who shall decide what is good and what is evil? All the traditional systems have placed ethics and values beyond man's reach. Oh, that's true. For human history, human cultures of different persuasions all knew that the good or the evil, the right or the wrong, moral values and duties, these transcended humans. They were somewhere in the transcendent realm. But Monod writes, values did not belong to humans, he belonged to them. Yet, he now knows that they are his and his alone. Humans get to invent right and wrong. And moral values no sooner come into his possession than they seem to melt into the world's uncaring emptiness. Oh yeah, it feels so good to get rid of morality. You know, so that way I can go out and do whatever I want. Wouldn't that be great? Like we could just get rid of any kind of ethics and just whatever makes me feel good would be the good. That would be so great, wouldn't it? Here's Monod's point. As soon as the whole realm of ethics goes into your hands, it melts away. You realize there is no difference between right and wrong, only pleasure. That's all it is. So fleeting. Goes away in a second. He says, modern man turns towards science, or rather against it, measuring its terrible capacity to destroy not only bodies, but the soul itself. When we realize that we're cosmic orphans, we're the accidental pregnancy of matter acting on energy and time and chance, that we don't have a cosmic father, that there's no meaning, there's no purpose, we realize that it's not just that our bodies are worthless, but our souls have been completely eviscerated. And so, he says, all things are wearisome, more than one can say. You can't even put words to how terrible this is. You guys depressed yet? All right, hang in there. We got more. The eye has never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing about this. What has been will be again, and what has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already, long ago. It was here before our time. I know what you're thinking. The iPhone? Space travel? I mean, if you brought Solomon in, you know, 3,000 years later and you showed him the iPhone, space travel. Hey, we took a rocket and we lit it on fire and we blew it into space and there was three guys on it and they landed on the moon. He'd be like, wow, that's new. That's new. He would admit that. I think he would admit that. Here's the point though. Technology, art, industry, they make life easier, faster. For what? So instead of rushing toward the finish line of purposelessness, hurtling as fast as we can, faster and faster, toward what end? What's the point? You see his point? Humanity is just going quicker and easier into oblivion. That is what has never changed. The planetary cycles. Yeah, we got a phone, and yeah, it goes to space and stuff, and I can call people. Cool. I can call people who are going to die, just like me. Oh, we went to the moon. That worked out real well. We put down a flag, and we were like, hoorah, and then we came back. And then the next flight, nobody even knows who they were. Nobody can even name who the three guys were on the next Apollo mission. You don't even know who they were. So he says, there's no remembrance. Here we go. No remembrance of people of old. Even those who are not yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. Like this guy here. You guys know who this guy is? Anybody here? Nobody? There is no remembrance of people of old. You don't know who this guy is? Okay, I'll give you his name. His name is Sir Tim Berners-Lee. Anybody know? Guys, this guy invented the internet. You know the internet, like that thing you're probably on right now on your phone, trying to make eye contact with me at the same time, like doing like the cross-eyed thing, like you're kind of looking at me. Yeah, this is the guy, Tim Berners-Lee. He invented the World Wide Web in 1989. All right, he invented it. He's still alive. He hasn't even died yet. He's 66 years old, and you don't even know who he is. There's no remembrance of people of old. Good God, man. Yeah, it's so true. It is shocking how quickly we forget people. He says in verse 12, I, the teacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. This means like exhaustive study. He had the time, he had the intellect, he had the leisure to do this. Yet he says, what a heavy burden God has laid on the human race. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. This is in the sense that Solomon is saying his own finitude and his own fallenness. He couldn't crack the code. He couldn't figure it out. I said to myself, look, I have grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ever ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly, but I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. What's his point? The more we think about the human predicament, that there is no meaning in an ultimate sense, there is no purpose in an ultimate sense, there are no moral values in an ultimate sense, the more we think about that, the less content in life we can be. This is the human predicament. The only thing we can do is just try to ignore it and have fun. Yeah, go to the arcade, go to play video games, go to, you know, shoot up drugs, go and have a, you know, sex affair, do whatever you can, just to forget that your life is completely vapid and vacuous, has no meaning whatsoever. The more he thought about it, the more he was deeply grieved. Here's a good book, The Human Predicament. There we go. David Benatar, professor of philosophy at the University of Cape Town. He says, we exist now, but we won't exist for long. That is true of us as individuals, but in the grand sweep of planetary time, let alone cosmic time, it is also true of our species and all life. Earthly life is thus without significance, import, or purpose beyond our planet. It is meaningless from the cosmic perspective. Because this is true of all life, it is true of all sentient life, and it's true of all human life, and it's true even of you. Whatever other kinds of meaning our lives might have, the absence of this meaning is deeply disturbing to many. Think about it like this. Imagine, and those of you who are into the hard sciences, you're going to be grimacing over this illustration. It's just an illustration. Bear with me, okay? There's a fish that exists in a world where there's no air, only water. Immediately you're like, oh, we need air to have the water with the oxygen and the thing. Okay, forget it. All right, the fish in a world where there's no air and it's only water. And this fish ends up evolving lungs. The species of fish evolves lungs in a world with no air. Here's my question. Is the fish better off or worse off? Well, it's worse off because it suffocates to death. It lives in a universe where there's no air to have something central to its functioning be used. And so that fish would suffocate, right? You say, well, no, maybe it'd be good because it could have a Darwinian advantage to be able to get up onto the ocean. There's no air in this universe. That's the idea. It just sits there and suffocates and dies. Now, imagine that there is a species of hominins on planet Earth, and they exist in a meaningless universe. There is no meaning, there is no hope, there is no purpose. And yet they feel all these things. They have a sense of logic. The canons of logic are real. And they feel a sense of meaning and purpose and love and human dignity and equality and justice, things that are integral to the human existence and life. But these things don't exist. Here's the question. Is this species better off or worse off? Now, someone might say, well, it'll help them to have a better coherent society and to have laws and so forth. No, no, no. You're missing the point. That's only making a very comfortable oblivion for each one of us. In this scenario, in a universe without God, in a naturalistic universe, humans should be pitied because evolution took a twisted turn, giving us consciousness of the fact that there is no meaning, there is no purpose, there are no moral values. We are just doomed to death. We are definitely to be most pitied of any species. Annie Dillard, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author, puts it better than me. She writes, this direction of thought, oh, background. She was looking at a little insect sticking its plunger. Have you guys ever seen Starship Troopers where it sticks that big thing into the head of the one guy and it sucks his brains out? Nobody saw it. All right, anyways, this little insect sticks its, you know, plunger into the brains of this little aphid or something, I can't remember, and it sucks the brains out. And she was looking at this with horror. My God, that's horrible. But then she starts to think about this. She says, this direction of thought brings me abruptly to a fork in the road where I stand paralyzed, unwilling to go on, for both ways lead to madness. Consider the former. The world is a monster. Any three-year-old can see how unsatisfactory and clumsy is this whole business of reproducing and dying by the billions. But wait, you say, there is no right and wrong in nature. Right and wrong is a human concept. Precisely. We are moral creatures then in an amoral world. The universe that suckled us is a monster that doesn't care if we live or die, doesn't care if it itself grinds to a halt. It is fixed and blind, a robot programmed to kill. We are free in seeing. We can only try to outwit it at every turn to save our own skins. This view requires that a monstrous world, running on chance and death, careening blindly from nowhere to nowhere, somehow produced wonderful us. We little blobs of soft tissue crawling around on this one planet's skin are right, and the whole universe is wrong. Then again, I must consider the second fork in the road, that creation itself is blamelessly, benevolently askew by its very free nature, and that it is only human feeling that is freakishly amiss. We are the freaks. The world is fine. And let us all go have lobotomies to restore us to a natural state. You see the point? If evolution took us to the point where we have consciousness of reason and logic and human dignity and human rights and values and purpose and meaning, what we should do is just take a little bit of that prefrontal cortex, just a little, not much, go up through the nose, take a little snip, get rid of it, so that we can get rid of that whole idea. And consequently, we can leave the library then. We won't need that. We can go back to the creek lobotomized and live on its banks as untroubled as any muskrat or reed. And she concludes, you first. What would it be to be in that predicament? Either the universe is wrong and I am right, or I am right and I'm wrong and the universe is right. One path leads to nihilism, that nothing matters. The other path leads to a complete existential despair, because I have no foundation for the things which are most meaningful in life. There is another way. When Solomon said in verse 9, there's nothing new under the sun, that is true. But according to the Bible, God entered this world from the heavens through the person of Jesus Christ. And he brought in a new covenant, a new agreement between us and God that we can be freely forgiven. He makes us a new creation. We have a new identity. He gave us a new commandment to love. We have a new community. We can approach God in a new and living way, and we can anticipate a new heavens and new earth. So far, what I've been arguing is not that this God exists. I haven't given you any evidence at all that Christianity is true, have I? All I've done is said that the alternative to this is complete, abject despair. So if you're a thinking person, and it was 50-50 whether Christianity was true or naturalism was true, why wouldn't you think to investigate Christianity? Let me push that a little bit further. If there was only a 1% chance that Christianity was true, wouldn't you at least want to find the view that had hope, that had significance, and had purpose? Well, the Bible teaches that you can have that. And you can have that through the very simple experience of coming to Christ right now as you are. No changing, no ceremonies, no rituals, nothing. Just by praying to God, your Creator, and inviting Him into your life, experiencing the free gift of Christ. And if you do that, you can move over from this state of wondering what it's all about to knowing precisely what it's all about, experiencing the love of your Creator.